Greetings, and welcome to the Science Podcast for October 27th, 2006. I'm Stuart Wills, the online editor of Science Magazine. In today's show, we'll look at an alternative view on the role of gender in science and math education. We'll also explore how genetic researchers are using a tool called single nucleotide polymorphisms, or SNPs, to look at two very different problems, the origins and migrations of the honeybee, and the molecular mechanisms of a common human intestinal scourge, inflammatory bowel disease. All that, plus our usual roundup of other stories from Science and its daily news website, Science Now. So stick around. A common view holds that because there are significant psychological differences between boys and girls, accounting for gender in education plans, through such mechanisms as single-sex classrooms, can boost performance for both groups. But in the Education Forum section of the October 27 Science, Janet Hyde of the University of Wisconsin and Marcia Lynn of UC Berkeley argue that boys and girls are much more similar in learning styles and capabilities than is commonly assumed, and that this has some big implications for math and science education. Dr. Hyde is on the line with us now to tell us more. Dr. Hyde, thanks for being with us.
I'm glad to do it.
Dr. Hyde, before diving into the specifics of your argument, tell us a little bit more about the conventional wisdom on this issue and why people tend to assume that there are these gender differences.
Well, our culture is filled with media messages that tell us there are huge differences between boys and girls and between men and women. John Gray's book, Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, is one of the best exemplars. You know, men and women are so different, it's like they're from different planets. So the mass media are just telling us constantly that males and females are very different from each other.
And I guess you've looked at an alternative hypothesis, that boys and girls are actually quite similar. How did you go about testing that hypothesis?
Right. My hypothesis is called the gender similarities hypothesis. And to test that hypothesis, I used a statistical technique called meta-analysis, which I won't necessarily bore your listeners with. But basically, it's a statistical technique that allows you to put together all the data from a whole lot of studies that have been done on a particular question so that you can find out, averaging over all these studies, for example, I found 100 studies on gender and math performance, averaging over all those studies, is there a significant gender difference, who scores higher, and how big the difference is. So what I did is I found all the meta-analyses I could on psychological gender differences. I actually found 46 of them, put all those data together, and when you look at how big the gender differences are from across all those 46 meta-analyses, most of them are in the small range. They're small or even close to zero in magnitude, meaning that males and females are very similar.
Well, let's drill down now to science and math education in particular, which was the focus of your essay. As you note in that essay, in the U.S., there was something called the National Assessment of Educational Progress, which involves tests of hundreds of thousands of students, and that found a statistically significant difference in the math and science achievement between genders, with males outperforming females in science in all three grades tested. But I gather from what you're saying that that doesn't tell the whole story.
Well, right. NAEP has these results published online, and they have a big banner headline that says something like boys outperform girls on math and science. But if you actually look at the data, and they very nicely do give you the data, the average scores for boys and girls at the three grades they tested, I think it was 4th, 8th, and 12th grade, the scores are less than 4 points apart on a test where scores can range from 0 to 300. So we're talking about maybe 3 or 4 points out of 300 points. And if you do these statistical analyses I do, you find that that's just a tiny, tiny difference. The reason it's statistically significant is that they test 100,000 kids in each grade, and that's one of the phenomena in statistics. If you get a very large sample size, you can get things to be statistically significant that just aren't big enough to be important. So, you know, the NAEP people have told us that boys do better on science performance tests, but in fact, girls did almost identically as well.
And you make a very interesting point, at least I thought it was interesting, with respect to comparisons with other countries as well.
Well, right. We have some interesting data out of University of Michigan and Harold Stevenson's lab, where they tested fifth graders in performance on word problems. And so that's a higher level math. It's not just memorization, you know, what's 7 plus 8, but it's higher level word problems. So they tested fifth graders in the U.S., Taiwan, and Japan. Now, in each one of those countries, the boys did just an itty-bitty bit better. But the real tale is in the cross-cultural differences in performance, because the Taiwanese and the Japanese kids perform way better than the American kids. So, for example, the Taiwanese and Japanese girls do way better than American boys. So that says to me the gender issues are not the big ones by far, but in fact, the issues are cultural ones, the emphasis we place on homework and good performance, the way mathematics is taught, and so on. Those are the real issues, not gender.
So this gender difference that everyone makes such a big thing about is actually dwarfed by these other factors.
Exactly.
And what does all this mean, Dr. Hyde, in your view, in terms of the educational strategies we should be adopting with respect to math and science? Does gender awareness have any role at all here?
Well, the thing that I think is distressing to me in view of these data are calls for things like single-sex schools, single-sex classrooms, different curricula for girls and boys having to do with math and science. And I think some of the people who suggest this have the best of intentions. They think that girls will really be able to flourish under these circumstances, and so will boys. My question is, first of all, why gender? Why is gender our basis for making educational decisions? For example, if I said, well, all the black children will go to that classroom and all the white children will go to this classroom, we wouldn't consider that acceptable. So I wonder why gender is an acceptable way for sorting people. But it's also scientifically not a good way of sorting people, because girls' and boys' performance in math is so similar. There are things about learning styles that people try to argue that girls and boys have different learning styles. We couldn't even find a meta-analysis on that question, so I just don't see the evidence for it. Girls and boys are so similar psychologically. If you really do want to form classrooms for kids who are too active and aggressive to be in the classroom with the other kids who are more well-behaved, don't make it boys and girls. Make it kids who are more active and aggressive.
Put the aggressive girls in there with the aggressive boys.
Exactly. If aggressiveness is a problem in the classroom, sort kids out on the basis of aggressiveness.
Well, Dr. Hyde, thanks very much for chatting with us today.
Okay, I'm glad to do it.
Janet Hyde is the co-author with Marcia Lynn of Gender Similarities in Mathematics and Science, an article in the Education Forum section of Science. You can find it in the October 27th issue or online at the journal's website, science.sciencemag.org. Just around the corner, the honeybee's genetic journey. Stay with us.
Did you know that AAAS members benefit from special access to a daily news service, weekly funding updates, monthly research roundups, and newsletters? Members also get discounts on books, travel, scientific events, including our annual meeting, workshops, seminars, and more. This in addition to 51 weekly issues of the premier journal Science. To join or renew, go to www.AAAS.org/membership. AAAS, advancing benefits for members.
The recently completed Honeybee Genome Project offers the opportunity for new genetic insights on one of the most economically important social insects. In a study published in this week's Science, Dr. Charles Whitfield of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and 9 colleagues used the new honeybee genome sequence to get a better handle on the population genetics and diversity of the insect. Dr. Whitfield is on the line with us now for a closer look. Dr. Whitfield, welcome.
Hello, Stuart.
First, Dr. Whitfield, your study is one of several in this week's Science on the honeybee, and, of course, the recent completion of the honeybee genome sequence will set the stage for a lot more work on this organism. Before we get into the details of what your team looked at, why are these studies important?
Both the genome paper and our paper are really developing a set of molecular tools that we can use to approach the honeybee and really develop this as a molecular model system. The reason this is important is that the honeybee is, as you say, it's very important economically, primarily for pollination, but also for products such as honey and wax, things like that. But it's also very fascinating scientifically as a model system, in particular for its social behavior. So within the model animal systems that we study, there isn't another one that is so simple in the sense that it's a small insect with a genome that's physically small, but has a very complex social behavior. And that social behavior impacts basically everything about the honeybee.
And you looked in particular at the population distribution of honeybees and bee hybrids. Before you started, what did we know about this topic? What were the main sort of questions you were trying to address?
So we know that the honeybee species, Apis mellifera, it's native to Europe and Africa and Asia. It has a pretty wide distribution. And honeybees in the New World that you see in North or South America are all introduced at one time or another. Within the native ranges, there are at least two dozen different distinct subspecies. What wasn't known was the relationships between these different subspecies, basically who is close to who, and in particular, where did the species originate within that large range.
And so how did you go about looking at this?
We developed a marker, which is called a single nucleotide polymorphism, or SNP, or SNP for short. And we identified, using the genome sequence, we identified a putative set of SNPs, a very large set of SNPs, tens of thousands of them. We actually tested 1,536 of these SNPs and found 1,136 of these SNPs were useful to us. That is, we could look at these markers and we could find polymorphism within the populations that we studied.
So these SNPs are basically differences in a single base pair that are characteristic of a population or a group?
That's right, or show variation either within or between populations.
And so what did you find looking at these SNPs?
We found a couple things that were surprising. One of the things we found was that by looking at the genotypes of Apis mellifera, but also in other related species, other species in the Apis genus, we found that it appears that the Apis mellifera originated in Africa. This is actually surprising to us because all of the other species within the genus, there are about nine species of Apis, all of the other species occur in Asia. So it was generally thought that probably Apis mellifera split from its sister species in Asia and then subsequently migrated into Europe and Africa. But our results indicate that all of the existing populations originated from populations in Africa. So the other interesting thing was that several of these populations, for example, those we find in Western and Eastern Europe, are the most distant within the species.
Genetically distant, you mean?
Yeah, that's right. In fact, each of these populations, Western and Eastern European bees, were more similar to African honeybees than they were to each other. So putting some of these results together, we hypothesized that the honeybees, the species Apis mellifera, originated in Africa, and there were at least two migrations out of Africa, and these gave rise to these populations that are geographically very close, but genetically very different.
Well, that's interesting. Is there any way to tell from the genetic data when these migrations might have taken place and what might have caused them? I know that there's been some genetic work done on human migrations, for example, along those lines.
This might be possible, and that is a very important question that I think follows from our work. It is known that it's an ancient expansion, and that's not from our work. It's also known that bees were not, for example, in Northern Europe during the last ice age. So we can infer some of the age of some of these movements based on fossil records, but not from our data.
I understand the study also has something to say about Africanized hybrid bees in the New World, the so-called killer bees that were so much in the news a number of years ago.
Yes, the killer bees are actually a subspecies of honeybee that came from South Africa, and the subspecies is called Apis mellifera scutellata. Scutellata was actually introduced to Brazil in 1956, and it quickly spread north and south and displaced other honeybees that were in the area. Now, I just told you that honeybees are native to Europe, Africa, and Asia, so in one sense, this Africanization was an invasion on top of an invasion. So they were actually not replacing native honeybees. They were replacing previously introduced honeybees. This process, it was not known before how much this Africanization involves replacement of previously introduced European bees versus introgression with these European bees. Now we have a fairly clear idea to what extent Africanization involves replacement versus introgression. And in fact, we see evidence for both. And so basically every honeybee in the New World is a mixed genotype, and you can see the history of these genotypes in the SNP data that we have.
Well, Dr. Whitfield, thanks for being with us today.
All right. Thank you very much, Stuart.
Dr. Charles Whitfield is the author, with nine colleagues, of a paper in the October 27 Science that examines genetic evidence for ancient and recent migrations of the honeybee. Coming up in a moment, the mechanisms of inflammatory bowel disease.
Did you know that AAAS members help plug the power of science into public policy? Since 1973, we've brought nearly 2,000 scientists and engineers to Washington, D.C. as science and technology policy fellows. They provide scientific analysis to policymakers in congressional offices and in federal agencies. Find out more at fellowships.AAAS.org. AAAS, advancing science careers, enhancing public policy.
Next, the genetics of inflammatory bowel disease. Affecting millions of persons worldwide, IBD is really a collection of chronic conditions, including most notably Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis, that share symptoms such as abdominal pain, diarrhea, and gastrointestinal bleeding. In a study published online in Science this week, Richard Duer, Judy Cho, and 21 other investigators from the seven-institution NIDDK-IBD Genetics Consortium report on the discovery of a rare genetic variant that offers a better understanding of the molecular workings of IBD and that could help guide future efforts to develop treatments. Dr. Duer and Dr. Cho are on the line with us now to talk a bit more about this work. First, Dr. Cho, I've described some of the symptoms of these inflammatory bowel disorders, but how exactly do these diseases develop? What causes these symptoms?
The symptoms result from a chronic, often intermittent, intestinal inflammatory process. Inflammation generally reflects the body's attempt to fight off infection. The intestine is in the unique position of being close to a very high concentration of microbes in the form of intraluminal bacteria. And IBD represents an inappropriate inflammatory response to normal intestinal bacterial flora.
So it's basically sort of fighting back, the body fighting back against something it doesn't even have to fight back against.
Precisely.
And I guess before you looked at this in detail in this study, there was already some evidence that there's at least some genetic component to how these diseases are passed along.
Yeah, that's true. IBD is caused by a combination of genetic, developmental, and environmental factors. Support that genetic factors play a role in disease is provided by epidemiologic observations of familial aggregation combined with twin studies. Within geographic regions, disease prevalence is higher in Ashkenazi Jews compared to non-Jewish European ancestry individuals. Finally, a couple of genes have been definitively associated to IBD, most notably the NOD2 or CARD15 gene. This association is very strong.
Okay, so with all of that as kind of background, maybe you could tell us a bit more about this study. Dr. Duer, what were you looking to find out, and how did you proceed?
Well, the genetic makeup of different people is more than 99% identical, and less than 1% of the human genome varies between different people. So to identify additional genes that are associated with IBD, Our U.S. and Canadian team of researchers scanned the genome, all 22,000 or so genes, by testing more than 300,000 genetic variants called single nucleotide polymorphisms, or SNPs, in people with Crohn's disease. We also tested these SNPs in a similar number of people without IBD for comparison.
So you were attempting to sort of compare two populations and see the genetic associations within those populations.
Yes, we were comparing people with Crohn's disease and healthy people to determine whether there were differences in the frequencies of different generic variations in those two populations.
And so what did you find from comparing these populations?
Out of the hundreds of thousands of SNPs, the genome-wide scan found that three were most strongly associated with Crohn's disease. Of those three, two were in the CARD15 gene that Judy Cho talked about. The third SNP was in a different gene on a different chromosome. When we looked at the specific gene where the third SNP resided, we found that it coded for a protein that is part of the immune cell receptor for interleukin-23, which is an important mediator of inflammation in the body. This interleukin-23 receptor SNP is relatively uncommon, being present at an allele frequency of around 7% in the general white European ancestry population that we studied. To our surprise, we found that it appears to confirm protection against developing IBD because it is even less common in patients with IBD, including patients with Crohn's disease and patients with ulcerative colitis, than it is in healthy control subjects. We also found other more common variants in the interleukin-23 receptor gene that appear to confer risk for developing IBD.
If I'm understanding what you're saying correctly, most people have this version of the gene that you mentioned that would predispose them to IBD, but there is this rare variant of this gene that seems to offer some protection against the disease. From an evolutionary point of view, that seems kind of counterintuitive. Why would that happen? It seems that you would have expected evolution to select for the protective allele.
There's a couple of answers. First, the glutamine or protective variant, as are many variants of relatively low frequency, might well be a relatively recent mutation in human history, not having sufficient time to increase in frequency in the population. Secondly, the major factors that are evolutionarily selected on are those that affect reproductive fitness. In human history, a key factor would be the capacity to survive important infectious pathogens that would result in death prior to reproduction. It could be speculated that the glutamine or protective variant, while protecting against IBD, may be relatively less effective in warding off historically significant pathogens.
I see. So it's not going to, nobody's going to be prevented from reproducing by inflammatory bowel disease.
Generally not.
Yeah. So I gather that, and all of this kind of ties in, as Dr. Dewar was pointing out, to this interleukin-23 cytokine, which I guess has also been implicated in studies of some other chronic inflammatory conditions, such as multiple sclerosis and arthritis. So I guess the new association you've uncovered makes sense from that standpoint as well.
Yes, indeed. The interleukin-23 cytokine is an important pro-inflammatory cytokine that appears to be important in a variety of different immune-mediated chronic diseases, such as rheumatoid arthritis, multiple sclerosis, as you mentioned, asthma, and inflammatory bowel disease, among others. It's interesting that recent studies in mice in which the gene for interleukin-23 is deleted or deficient demonstrated that interleukin-23 is an essential component for the development and maintenance of chronic inflammation.
So, Dr. Cho, does this study give us a leg up on treatment of these diseases?
I think it might from a couple of perspectives. First, it prioritizes this pathway as being directly involved in human disease. The knowledge that chronic inflammatory diseases in humans result from variation in the IL-23 pathway provides us with the conviction that targeting of this pathway may be particularly effective. Now, this pathway has already been targeted in the sense that an early clinical trial using an antibody against the P40 subunit shared between the interleukin-12 and interleukin-23 cytokines has been shown to be effective in the treatment of Crohn's disease. An important issue now is whether specific targeting of the IL-23 pathway will be more or less effective than general targeting of both interleukin-12 and interleukin-23. The knowledge that one out of about every seven individuals carries a copy of the protective allele with no apparent deleterious effect provides an important assurance that careful modulation of the IL-23 receptor can potentially be achieved in a safe and effective manner.
Well, Dr. Cho, Dr. Dewar, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Richard Dewar and Judy Cho are the authors, with 21 others, of a new study on the genetics of inflammatory bowel disease. The study was published online this week on the Science website. Finally today, our usual roundup of some interesting stories from Science's free daily news site, Science Now. David Grimm, the editor of Science Now, is in the studio with Tanisha Riley of AAAS.
David, good to see you today.
Good to see you too.
So what have you got for us today?
Three cool stories, as always. Scientists have thought there was water on the moon, but it may just be a mirage. I'll tell you why pulling an all-nighter makes you forgetful. And finally, we'll talk about a fish that uses its own excretions to hide from predators.
Okay, well, let's first talk about water on the moon, or should I say no water on the moon?
Yeah, it's a good question. Well, in 1996, a spacecraft called Clementine had bounced some radar signals off the moon, and basically it thought it was detecting ice on the moon. And the reason scientists had suspected there was ice on the moon anyways is because there's this theory that ice-filled comets were crashing into the moon and leaving ice there, and perhaps, especially in the colder regions of the moon, ice might be actually sticking around. And obviously NASA's very interested in this because they want to do manned missions to the moon, and they want to be able to harness this ice, not just for water for the astronauts, but also the water can actually be harnessed to make rocket fuel. But it looks like, according to a new study, that what Clementine saw might not actually be ice after all. A group at Cornell University used a couple of Earth-based radio dishes to bounce radar signals off the moon. And the places where they saw these sort of quote-unquote ice signals were not places you would expect to see ice. They were in craters where there was a lot of sunlight, in the warmer areas of the moon, not in these shady, colder areas. So it looks like it's probably not ice that Clementine saw in the first place.
Well, if it's not ice, then what is it?
Well, these areas where they're picking up these quote-unquote ice signals are sort of characterized by crater ejecta and slumping rock, and so it's possible that these signals are being confused for ice, but maybe it's just some strange rock formations.
So the moon may be as dry as it looks after all.
Yeah, it's still up in the air. I mean, the recent evidence definitely isn't encouraging. NASA's got a mission planned in 2008 that will take some more signaling of the moon, and there's also going to be apparently a mission where they're actually going to crash an object into the moon and see if it kicks up any ice. So we'll just have to wait a couple more years to know for sure.
How about this next story? Pulling an all-nighter in college can take a toll on your memory. That's certainly something I can remember, or can I?
Well, I mean, I guess it doesn't sound that surprising that if you don't get a good night's sleep, that your brain's not going to work as well the next day. But scientists hadn't really looked at, what effect this really had on memory. So what they did was a group at Harvard University paid 10 undergraduates to go a night without sleep. And the next morning, these undergraduates came in, and basically the scientists gave them a series of 30 words to try to remember. And a couple days later, after the students had rested up, the scientists tested how many of these words the students had remembered.
So how well did they remember?
Well, not very well, especially compared to the controls. So the students that hadn't slept, had pulled the all-nighter, recalled about 40% fewer words than a control group of 10 students that had gotten a good night's sleep. And what was really interesting was that it really depended on the kind of words that the students were asked to remember. So they were given both positive and negative words. And when I say positive words, they were given words like happy or sunshine, and negative words were words like cancer or jail. And what they found was that the sleep-deprived students only remembered about 19% of the positive words, but remembered about 59% of the negative words.
And why would they remember the more negative words better?
Well, they think it's an evolutionary thing. You know, our brains are primed to prepare us for threats, and negative words have sort of more of a threat connotation. So perhaps even if we are forgetful, we're more likely to focus on the negative words than the positive ones.
And finally, this last story on the Gulf toadfish. I guess this animal has developed a kind of unusual cloaking device?
Yeah, it's pretty unusual. There's been a sort of a long-standing puzzle in the fish community, and the background is that most fish dispose of their white waste in the form of ammonia. And ammonia works for most of them because, once they excrete it, it diffuses easily in the water, and it's not a very energy-consuming process for them to make this ammonia. But scientists have also noticed that some fish secrete urea instead of ammonia. And urea is much harder to make, so it costs the fish a lot more energy. But the fish that do this, that excrete urea, tend to live in waters with high pH. And the problem with high pH is high pH doesn't dissolve ammonia very well. So if the fish were to excrete ammonia, the ammonia would sort of stick around in the water that they were in and could kill the fish. But the urea dissolves easily. So it's worth it for these fish to spend a little bit more energy making urea because they know it's going to basically diffuse in the water and not hurt them. But there's an interesting case of a fish called the Gulf toadfish, which excretes both urea and ammonia. And scientists have been trying to figure out for years why this is. Why would they waste energy making urea, and especially because they live in waters that dissolve ammonia quite well. So they really don't need to be spending the energy to make this urea as well as ammonia. So a team of evolutionary physiologists wondered whether the reason was because of predators. And one of the most common predators for the Gulf toadfish is the gray snapper. So what the team did was they got this large tank, and they put a gray snapper inside, and they put an artificial toadfish shelter in there. And what they found is, well, first of all, what they did was they added some ammonia near the shelter, or they would add ammonia and urea near the shelter, or they would add just urea alone. And what they found was that all three of the compounds attracted the gray snapper, but the ammonia attracted the gray snapper a lot more than the urea and urea ammonia mixture.
So why excrete both?
So that's a good question, because again, you still have the issue of, why are they excreting both ammonia and urea? And it seems to be a trade-off. Ammonia is easier to make, and they know the fish know it's going to dissolve in the water. So perhaps when predators are not around, they can excrete ammonia. But if they are concerned about predation, they can spend a little bit more energy and excrete urea, which is going to mask some of the smell from ammonia and perhaps keep the fish safe from their predator, the gray snapper.
David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the free online daily news service of science. You can catch up with these and other stories on the site at sciencenow.sciencemag.org.
And that wraps up the October 27, 2006 Science Podcast. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society, with additional financial support from the Golden Fund. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science. Jeffrey Cook composed the music for the podcast, and our sound editor for this show was Robert Harris. I'm Stuart Wills, the online editor of Science. On behalf of the journal and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.